someone to love you. I know it's true, I love you. I found someone who loves me. Who believes in me? I found someone who really believes in me. I found someone who believes in me. I found someone who believes me. I know it's true. I love you. I found someone who loves me.
need. Yes, I need. Got married in Portland town, had children 1, 2, 3. Yes, I did. Yes, I did. Yes, I did. They sent them away to war. Ain't got no kids no more. No, I ain't. No, I ain't. No, yes, I was, yes, I was, yes, I was.
China has for a long time endured much humiliation to accomplish the task of making Russia a friendly ally. Through more than a century, Russia has occupied over 1.5 million square kilometers of Chinese territory, an area 3 times the size of France. Many years ago, China gave up any claim on these lands, and the two nations jointly declared the Sino-Russian borders fixed. As long as China doesn't bring this matter up again, there is no further reason why China and Russia should have any major conflicts. Russia is very large, its population is in decline, it is under threat militarily from the power of NATO on its Western Front. It is expending all of its strength on managing the instability of its income from energy resources, controlling its non-Russian ethnic minority populations, and reasserting the power and influence of the former Soviet Union. Russia is over-dependent on energy exports, and so this latest round of global economic decline hit it very hard. Fortunately, when Europe reduced its imports of natural gas from Russia, China immediately increased its purchases of Russian energy. From then on, Russian oil and natural gas and other staple exports, such as heavy weaponry and Siberian timber, were guaranteed a Chinese market. In 2010, Russian oil was already flowing through the Siberian Pacific pipeline from Skovrodina to Daqing in Heilongjiang province, and now natural gas also comes into China from Yakutia through the 6,700-kilometer Yakutia-Khabarovsk-Vladivostok gas pipeline. All this reduces Russia's dependence on the European market, as well as diversifying China's supplies of fossil fuel resources. Due to their lack of capital and their close ties to the government, several Russian oligarchic enterprises competed to accept China's friendly state enterprise investments in joint monopolies of Russian titanium, gold, and other precious metals. We can thus say, in economic terms, China and Russia are mutually supportive. Having noticed this fact, recently many Russian regions bordering on China have altered their attitudes and tacitly allowed or even openly welcomed Chinese capital, businesses and workers to come in and cooperate in their development. For the sake of our two nations' core interests and in consideration of our grand strategies, as long as China doesn't bring up the question of its lost territory, China and Russia are perfectly able to live in peaceful coexistence. He Dongshen said that this recent great shift in the global center of gravity presented China with the opportunity of a century. In the past few years, China has been developing quite smoothly, but in order to have long-term security and to rule the nation and pacify the world, as the traditional phrase goes, He Dongshen believed that there was still one key move remaining, an alliance with Japan, to to make East Asia for the East Asians a reality, he said. Only when Japan changed its attitude, shook off the United States, and entered Asia could American imperialism be removed from East Asia and the Cold War arrangements finally collapse. Once the two Asian superpowers, China and Japan, joined hands, a new world order appeared, and a new post-Western, post-white era was ineluctably created. There was nothing Europe and America could do but accept it. This prospect was what had motivated Sun Yat-sen in 1924 when he went to Japan to promote Asianism and urge the Japanese not to emulate Western imperialism, but instead to join hands with China and make the traditional Chinese kingly way a reality. Sun Yat-sen was a nationalist. Do you think he didn't see Japan's ambitions? Ko Dong-shan asked his audience. He did, but he understood that neither China nor Japan alone had the might to force the Western powers out of Asia. But if they worked together, nothing could stop the rejuvenation of Asia. Sadly, though, Japan didn't heed Sun Yat-sen's good advice and went on to invade China and the rest of East Asia, ruining themselves and many others and causing both countries to suffer tremendous losses. Now the opportunity had come again. The leaders of China and Japan risked overwhelming internal opposition to conclude an alliance, signing the most comprehensive security treaty in the history of their two nations and an extremely close bilateral economic cooperation agreement. You probably don't know, said Ko Dong-shan, that Japanese military might is second only to that of the United States and China. He went on to relate that in theory, Japan's defense spending is only 1% of its GDP, but the Japanese economy is very large, and just as in China, much of its military spending is hidden in other budget items. These include naval forces, its space program, and its weapons research and development, none of which shows up in the national defense budget. Although Japan's official military spending is slightly less than China's, Japan leads in advanced technology, and many of Japan's civilian industries can be easily converted to military use. With Japan having a conventional military might equal to that of China and being so geographically close, it made China extremely nervous when it was not viewed as a friendly state, not to mention the continued presence of American troops in Japan, the island of Okinawa, and South Korea. By the same token, Japan had a similar feeling of unease as it witnessed China's rapid rise, which might have led it to abolish its peace constitution, become a normal country, start an arms race with China, accept the continuing presence of the United States in East Asia, and even unilaterally develop nuclear weapons. What sort of stability would there have been in East Asia if that happened? Both countries might have once more suffered equal and terrible losses. To disarm this time bomb, create a win-win situation for China and Japan, and force the US to withdraw from East Asia required great wisdom or a once-in-a-century stroke of luck. That stroke of luck was the global economic stagflation. One can say that Japan's economic depression had already lasted more than 20 years, and every time their situation seemed to improve, they would fall back again. They were growing weaker, and the latest global economic decline made recovery look too far away to imagine. Japanese industrial production, which had once looked down its nose at the rest of the world, seemed to have no hope of recovering any time soon. Chinese leaders saw this period of Japan's greatest weakness as an opportunity too good to pass up. They demanded that the isolationist and protectionist Japanese market immediately be opened up to China, especially to allow China to purchase Japanese companies. If Japan refused, China would take retaliatory measures to restrict the access of Japanese goods and businesses to the Chinese market. These demands were the straw that broke the Japanese camel's back. Now, China is Japan's number one trading partner, and the Japanese economy recovered somewhat between 2002 and 2008, largely due to its trade with China. In the end, and in the name of free trade, with great pomp and circumstance, the two nations concluded a most favored nation agreement. Both countries can now go in and out of each other's markets without restriction, just as in China's close bilateral economic cooperation agreement with its Hong Kong Special Economic Zone. This was the first time in history that Japan had freely opened its doors to another country. As these two markets rapidly became integrated, they were soon able to challenge the American and European economies. When China and Japan joined hands, South Korea and other Asian countries all expressed a desire to collaborate with them to establish an East Asian common market. Even Australia, New Zealand, Canada's two western provinces and the Latin American members of APEC all wanted to organize a Pacific and East Asian community. Besides expanding their free trade area, China and Japan also signed an unprecedented agreement to allow the free movement between the two countries of workers with special expertise or capital investors. To assist Japan with its problem of an aging population, Chinese immigrants to Japan have to be under 45, while no age limit was placed on Japanese immigrants to China. On the basis of this agreement, an estimated 50,000 or more Chinese will emigrate to Japan every year, about the same number that were going to Canada. These Chinese have various reasons for emigrating: to find employment, because travel is easier with a Japanese passport, because of the quality of the Japanese lifestyle, or because they don't want their children to endure the fierce competition for advancement in the Chinese education system. Most of the Japanese immigrants to China are senior citizens who can get much better value for money out of their pensions there, giving them both a higher standard of care and more enjoyment. China is helping Japan replenish its declining population with people of excellent quality. This policy also has great symbolic meaning, since it implies that China and Japan have forgotten their former enmity and now happily receive each other into their respective countries. The process is similar to how the traditional enemies, Germany and France, began to live in peaceful coexistence after the Second World War and also established a new order in Europe. Of equal importance, China and Japan signed a mutual non-aggression and national security treaty stipulating that if one of them was attacked, the other would come to its aid. It has the same structure as the United States-Japan Mutual Defense Treaty, the NATO alliance, or similar pacts between 19th century European powers. A brilliant Chinese aspect of this treaty was to allay Japanese anxiety by not demanding that Japan abrogate its mutual defense treaty with the US. Japan is now protected by both China and the United States. It has bought two insurance policies. The Sino-Japanese Security Treaty also put a restraint on North Korea. On the one hand, it meant that North Korea could no longer practice nuclear blackmail against Japan, because if Japan was attacked, China would come to its aid. On the other hand, Japan could no longer use the threat from North Korea to justify military expansion. After the stubborn South Korean regime began to feel isolated, they too considered signing a similar security treaty with China to further curb the power of North Korean militarism. "That's China for you," said He Dongshen with a smile. "All you have to do is recognize China as your friendly older brother, and everything can be easily accomplished, even if China has to give up some of its advantages." In the last century, Japan invaded China, and the Chinese people hate the Japanese to this day. But today's Japanese certainly do not hate the Chinese. They used to look down on us or even despise us, but now they fear us. In the past, they were the invaders. But surprisingly, they have no hate China complex. This is easily understood if we think about it. If you inflicted terrible harm on us in the past, naturally, you do not hate us now. The Japanese believe they were defeated by the Americans. Japanese territory had never before been occupied by a foreign power until the American post-war occupation, and there are still 50,000 US troops stationed on Japanese territory. Therefore, to this very day, the Japanese harbour a wish to see the Americans suffer a setback. This is part of the subtle but deep psychology between powerful and weak peoples, the invaders and the invaded, the victorious and the defeated in war. Another war is not necessarily the only way to take revenge and wipe away the shame. A reversal in the status of the high and the low, or at least a new equality in status, might suffice. That is why the East Asian Monroe Doctrine and the Sino-Japanese Mutual Security Treaty actually had so many supporters in Japan, because they were a slap in the face to the Americans. The subtext of the extremely close Sino-Japanese bilateral economic cooperation agreement was that Japan needs China's assistance, and that also gave many Chinese a strong feeling of self-respect. If Sun Yat-sen were alive today, he would surely congratulate China on the realization of its century-old dream. Well done, well done, was He Dongshen's proud conclusion. The best option in the real world. The realization of his century-old dream, protested Little C. If Sun Yat-sen were alive today, he'd die of anger. Sun's three people's principles were nationality, rights, and livelihood. Where are the people's rights now? In the last 100 years, their rights have been trampled all over by your Communist Party. Every time we turn round, you're cracking down, snatching people and throwing them in prison. She stamped her foot for emphasis. Right, said Fang Chaodi. You say social order is in danger. There are great contradictions and evildoers are running amok, but who's really responsible for stirring up all this social unrest? Isn't it all due to the corruption and incompetence of your Communist Party? It's been over 60 years since the founding of the People's Republic. Is the Nationalist KMT Party in power now? According to you, said Little C, China has already entered an age of ascendancy and prosperity. If that's so, why are you still unable to govern the country by the rule of law? Do you believe that China should never have the rule of law? After over 60 years in power, you're still unable to practice good government. The problem is that your Communist Party is fundamentally opposed to real political reform. Every new policy is designed to be a cash cow for your corrupt cadre and officials on every level. Can one party dictatorship solve the problem of your party's own corruption? Just look at your second generation rich, all these children of entrepreneurs and second generation officials, all those children of the party elite. They're disgusting. They're all fat cats of crony capitalism. She folded her arms in rebuke. The Chinese Communist Party is completely hypocritical, chimed Fang Chaodi. They're always lying, hiding the truth, distorting history. You cheat me and I cheat you. It starts with the top leadership and the lower echelons emulate them. Even the younger generation has been corrupted. When a nation that used to pride itself on its honesty has become so morally degenerate, how can you talk about prosperity and ascendancy? You've just been talking back and forth about the old ideal of enriching the state and strengthening the military, Old Chen chimed in now, about how to grab resources, how to stimulate economic growth to overtake Japan and catch up with the US, but the costs of your economic development have been tremendous. You've ruined the environment and exhausted all the resources of even your grandchildren's generation. Following the Western industrial nation's model of development, sooner or later you'll come to a dead end and be stopped in your tracks. Fang Chaodi had done business in Africa and had seen a very different picture from the one He Dongshen described. When Chinese enterprises worked on major infrastructure projects, they hired only Chinese workers. They didn't employ local workers and didn't help reduce the high levels of local unemployment. Cheap Chinese products flooded the African market and ruined those few manufacturing industries still in existence there. The Chinese were no different from the former European colonialists. They colluded with corrupt local ruling elites to exploit Africa's natural resources, and they didn't help the African people with any long-lasting economic development that could be of genuine assistance. Why is such a powerful nation so weak that it can't accept even the smallest amount of criticism? Asked Little Xi. Why do you stifle freedom of speech? Look how frightened you are of the internet. Not at all like a great nation. After Fang Chaodi had returned to China, he had travelled all over the minority people's regions. Because he was particularly looking for traces of his father and the former Xinjiang warlord Sheng Shikai, he went everywhere in North and South Xinjiang. His overall assessment was that the Communist Party's nationalities policy was a total failure. The Han Chinese complained about the injustice of positive discrimination, while the Uyghurs and Tibetans felt humiliated and oppressed. The local communist cadre in Xinjiang and Tibet were corrupt to the core and grew rich on the ethnic conflicts. With old hatreds and new complaints, Xinjiang and Tibet would never be at peace. "If China doesn't institute a federal system, there will be dire consequences," shouted Fang Chaodi. "Ke Dongshen," added Old Chen more calmly, "you're a typical old-style Chinese scholar. You have a head full of ideas about ruling the nation and pacifying the world, and you're dying to become an official and a state tutor. When you're close to power, you get all excited, and as soon as you enter the inner circle of power, you immediately support authoritarian dictatorship. You pretty it up with fancy words about needing absolute power to accomplish big things, but in fact, you are consumed by a burning personal ambition. Doing something big doesn't necessarily mean doing something good. You can also do something very bad that will have terrible and incalculable consequences for years to come. In the last several decades, there have been no lack of such examples, right?" He Dongshen listened with a smile, as if he was lapping up their criticism. "Everything you've said is true," he said, "but all the information you normally have can't possibly compare with the information I have access to. The two are completely out of balance. I can tell you several things that are even more terrible and absurd than those things you already know about. A couple of days ago, we had a meeting to discuss what kind of major catastrophe would arise if so much mud eroded off the hillsides along the Three Gorges Dam that it blocked the Yangtze River. Everybody knows that this is going to happen sooner or later. We just don't know which leadership group is going to be so unlucky as to have to clean up the fucking mess. But I'll tell you something for sure. You can't just watch other people do all the heavy lifting while you reap the benefits. You always have to give up something. Some lousy and irresponsible work will always be done here and there in a big country, but that's the only way it can function. I can tell you another thing straight from the heart. There is no possible way for China to be any better than it is today." "What do you mean? There is no way China could be any better than it is today," asked Little Seed indignantly. She threw up her hands. "Doesn't the West believe in God?" asked He Dongshen, ignoring her. "God created the world, and God is completely good. So God could not have deliberately created a bad world, right? But there are many things in the world that are not totally good. Many have struggled with this. The German philosopher Leibniz's Theodicy set out to defend God on this score. He proposed that, although the world is indeed not perfect, a perfect world is an impossibility because God had created the best possible world he could. If God can't even do it, how can China? China's current situation is as good as it can be under the existing circumstances, and it's a practical impossibility to make it better. You cannot just assume that China has Britain's parliamentary tradition, or Northern Europe's social democracy, or America's vast land resources. China is just China, and history is not a blank page that you can fill in any way you want to. You can't turn back the clock either. You can only start from the present situation. I firmly believe that today's China has already chosen the best option in the real world." "Voltaire long ago ridiculed Leibniz's philosophy that the world could not improve," said Old Chen. "In the words of Dr. Pangloss, all is for the best in the best of all possible worlds." Fang Chaodi wrinkled his brow in confusion. "Whatever you say," said Little C, "you're just defending your one-party dictatorship." "Well, can you propose a better, more complete and more feasible option?" asked He Dongshen. "Just because I can't do it," answered Little C, "doesn't mean that I want to accept your option." He Dongshen understood very well all the arguments and charges made by his captors. He knew that everything was due to the double-edged sword that was the Communist Party. Maybe the blame belonged to Lenin and Trotsky for first devising a one-party dictatorship. But can the CP dictatorship's Chinese capitalism with socialist characteristics be replaced by any other system? Or is it already the best option in the world as it really exists? One-party dictatorship is indeed incapable of eliminating its own corruption, and one-party dictatorship has to stifle freedom of speech and suppress any and all dissidents. But can China be controlled without a one-party dictatorship? Can any other system feed and clothe 1,350,000,000 people, or successfully administer an action plan for achieving prosperity amid crisis? Could China rise so fast without the leadership of a one-party dictatorship? He Dongshen allowed his words to settle in his captor's ears before continuing. Some people might think that now China has risen and its age of prosperity has begun, it can end its one-party dictatorship. The He Dongshen of 20 years ago might even have thought that. He might have joined the democratic reform faction within the party and even supported a Chinese Gorbachev. But now, He Dongshen has absolutely no faith in the Western democratic system. Even more importantly, he knows that since June 1989, the Chinese Communist Party no longer has any ideals. As a party-state regime with a total monopoly of power in China, the Communist Party rules only to preserve its own power. Today, He Dongshen not only has no passion for political reform, but he even cynically believes that there should be no such thing. There must not be any such reform, because any reform would lead to chaos. Just let China maintain the status quo, he said, and continue to develop smoothly for 20 more years, then we can see about reform. At the most, we can institute a few small reforms and gradually move towards good government. What would a post-communist party democratic China be like? Asked little Xi. He Dongshen had no idea. Political reform, he said with a sneer. Is it that easy? The result of political reform will not be the federalism that you want, or European-style social democracy, or American-style freedom and constitutional democracy. The result of such a political transition will be a Chinese-style fascist dictatorship made up of a combination of collective nationalism, populism, statism, and Chinese traditionalism. Your Communist Party state is already fascism, responded little C, raising her voice. You don't need any transition. Even if we are fascist, He Dongshen replied calmly, we are only in the early stages of fascism now. You still haven't tasted the full flavour of violent fascist despotism. From the way you talk, I can see that you lack the imagination to comprehend genuine evil. At that, the faces of a few Communist Party leaders he knew who harboured true fascist ambitions rose before his mind's eye, and he thought that if any of these men came to power, not only China but the whole world would be in for terrible trouble. He even had a certain sense of mission, a feeling that he must stop such people from coming to power. He Dongshen knew for certain that the opponents of the present leadership group came from both the left and the right, but the most dangerous threat was from the ultra-right. The action plan for achieving prosperity amid crisis was a continuation of the market economy policies of reforms and openness, and it had offended many powerful people and created many enemies. The old left and the new left both opposed the privatization of agricultural land. Many large state-operated enterprises were unhappy with the challenge posed by private businesses, where they had long enjoyed a monopoly. And finally, abolishing official control and encouraging competition had decreased the scope for collusion between bureaucrats and business people, as well as the officials' opportunities for graft. For a party in which deeply rooted corruption was endemic, the current leadership's attempts to put into effect a sunshine law, mandating that officials reveal their overall financial worth in order to uncover the discrepancies between their legal incomes and their actual wealth, so angered many corrupt officials that they resolved to work together to overthrow the current party state leadership. Ambitious factions within the party always look for the current leadership's weak spots. The two weak spots of this one were none other than their alliance with Japan and their postponement of border disputes. Anti-Japanese sentiment had widespread popular appeal that united several generations. Suddenly signing an oath of brotherhood with the Japanese was quite unacceptable to many, even though it was in accord with China's core national interests. It was also easy for joint development of border areas to be interpreted as a humiliating forfeiture of Chinese sovereignty. The ambitious faction within the party knew that all they had to do was fan the flames of nationalist sentiment and accuse the leadership of pandering to the foreigners, hinting at surrender or even treason, and the present leadership group might not be able to hold up. At the very least, their reputation with the people would collapse. And when the rest of the world saw the ensuing violent upsurge of Chinese nationalist sentiment, they would also come to believe that China was an expansionist and aggressive new empire. They would be convinced that the China menace theory was correct, and they would prepare for mutual hostilities and cease to trust the Chinese government. To see the present leadership group damned from inside and outside the country would be just exactly what that faction had in mind. He Dongshen feared that if this went on for very long, Chinese popular opinion would be hijacked by the ambitious fascist faction. He even began to reflect fondly on the now defunct liberal faction of intellectuals. Without them as a target, all of the anti-liberal forces, the old left and the new left, the nationalists, populists, traditionalists and ultra-right, directly concentrated all of their attacks on the present leadership group. Unfortunately, when the global economy went into decline and China's age of prosperity officially began, the liberal faction, accused of being pro-Western, sharply declined, and the market for their ideas dried up. After a period of reflection, most of the members of the liberal faction came to support the present pragmatic authoritarian leadership. They now believed that China could not follow the path of the Western nations, and that the present Chinese model was the best option in the world as it really exists. Those few well-known liberals who stubbornly refused to change their minds were effectively forbidden to voice their opinions. They could not appear in the media, publish, lecture, or teach. There was now only the occasional small fry, like little Xi, his eyes met hers, who went on the net and carried on a very weak guerrilla resistance. Heaven save the Communist Party. This was certainly a long, slow night. As Old Chun, Little Xi and Fang Chaodi listened to He Dongshen bombard them with information, their emotions went on a rollercoaster ride. They were totally exhausted and yawning continuously. Zhang Du had already dozed off several times, the tiny camera dangling on his knee. By contrast, the more He Dongshen talked, the more energized he became. It was as though he'd been hosting a one-man marathon talk show and didn't have to hold anything back. He could say whatever he wanted. It's great, he thought, to be able to say whatever I want. I haven't felt so happy in a long time. He also realized that he was saying things that he normally could not say. But if he didn't say them today, he would probably be measured for his coffin before he'd ever have another chance to talk like this. He was also fully aware that he had never before drunk Beijing tap water. But today he had downed several glasses and he was bound to have an unusual reaction to it. He Dongshen thought of a strange thing that had recently transpired and he just had to talk about it. Would not feel right if he didn't. I'm going to tell you, he said to his captors, a state secret. Last month, a terrorist organization infiltrated a top secret state-run chemical plant and tried to blow it up. Luckily, our security forces were tipped off in advance and killed them all on the spot. The astonishing thing was that those six terrorists were all members of a fascist cell centered on Beijing. They were all students from the elite Peking and Tsinghua universities. After we learned their identities, we kept it a secret and reported that they had died in an automobile accident. But not being given access to their bodies, for a while their parents raised a fuss. I'm telling you all this so you'll understand that real fascism already has a firm foothold in China. For these university students to know about this secret chemical factory, they would have to have accomplices in the party, the government and the army. And these people have their own agenda. They've not been true Communist Party members or socialists for some time, and only fascists can describe them.
Was one of the dead students named Wei? Asked Little Xi slowly.
Wei? No, answered He Dongshen.
Are you absolutely certain? She pressed him.
You don't need to doubt my memory, said He Dongshen. And besides, Wei is not a common surname. If there was a Wei,
I would definitely remember.
Seeing that little Xi looked relieved, Old Chen knew she was thinking of her son, Wei Guo. His heart went out to her.
How did you come to have advance warning? Old Chen asked randomly to change the subject.
Old Chen, you shouldn't underestimate our security apparatus, said He Dongshen. We have eyes and ears everywhere. In general, wherever people gather, we have informants. But then, how the fuck did we miss you three?
Why did they want to blow up that chemical factory? Fang Chaodi suddenly asked in all seriousness.
Since he'd already told them about the prosperity amid crisis and the ruling the nation and pacifying the world plans and the nation's grand international strategy, what else was there that He Dongshen could not talk about?
Let me put it this way, He Dongshen said. At China's present stage of development, the difference between our government and those fascist elements is that we want the people to have a loving and compassionate nature, not a martial spirit. But the fascists want to promote a martial or combative spirit. The chemical manufactured in that factory makes the Chinese people happy and full of love and compassion, and for that reason, the fascist elements wanted to destroy it. Do you understand what I'm saying? He looked directly into Fang Chaodi's eyes.
Is it the chemical factory near Happy Village in the Mount Taihang region of Hebei? Fang Chaodi asked, following a sudden intuition. The one that has its own airport?
You seem very well informed, He Dongshen said, his eyebrows raised. It seems there's been a leak in our security system.
What does that chemical factory make that caused the people to feel happy? Asked Fang Chaodi, pressing his line of inquiry.
Professor He,
you agreed that you would answer whatever question we asked.
There's no harm in telling you, said He Dongshen. And anyway, I don't think it's a bad thing.
If you've never heard of MDMA, surely you have heard of ecstasy. We manufacture Generation N of MDMA. It's mild, non-addictive, and has no bad side effects. After you take it, you feel really great. You feel like the world is full of love. You want to hug other people and tell them everything, but you're clear-headed and don't have any hallucinations, just like I am now.
What do you want such a big factory to make ecstasy tablets for? Asked Fang Chaodi, looking puzzled.
It's not making tablets, explained He Dongshen, as though Fang Chaodi should know. There aren't any tablets at all, and it's not to sell ecstasy to other countries. China is a big country, we're not North Korea, so don't get the wrong idea. We're merely producing this chemical for our own use.
Just as in Aldous Huxley's novel Brave New World, interjected Old Chen, happy to contribute a literary reference.
I know what you're trying to say, said He Dongshen a little defensively, but we were not at all influenced by him. We have an Office of Stability Maintenance, staffed by specialist scholars who conduct research on ancient and modern techniques for maintaining stability both inside and outside China. One of the scholars was working on British materials. You know that young people in Western countries like to drink and party wildly on New Year's Eve, and when they get drunk, they often cause trouble. Just look at their football games. The British fans are very unruly. For the last few years of the 20th century, though, when ecstasy became popular, New Year's Eve violence suddenly decreased. It turned out that after those British youths took ecstasy, they just wanted to dance around, bobbing their heads, to listen to music, embrace each other, love everybody, and pour out their hearts to everybody around them. This is the effect MDMA or ecstasy has on people, and it's very different from the effects of alcohol or other hallucinatory drugs. Alcohol messes up people's minds and releases their animal instincts. Psychedelic drugs cause hallucinations and interfere with normal social communication. Our Office of Stability Maintenance had the Harbin Institute of Technology make up some pure samples of MDMA. At first, they didn't know what it would be good for. They just wanted to experiment. Then, when the Politburo was studying the action plan for achieving prosperity amid crisis, one of the standing members was worried that the crackdown was going to make people depressed and passive. That would have a negative impact on the people's enthusiasm, just when we were trying to implement the second set of our new economic reform policies.
He wondered if there wasn't some substance that would make people feel good and positive, but without any violent tendencies that would disrupt our harmonious society. There was a spokesman from the Ministry of Public Security at the meeting who had trained at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He'd been studying the American drug problem, and he jokingly said that we could only have that sort of effect on society if everyone in China took methylene dioxy, methamphetamine, or MDMA, ecstasy. That's how it started, and the more we discussed it, the more we thought it might just work. One standing member said he'd never imagined there was anything like it in the world. The chief ingredient for the manufacture of MDMA ecstasy is sassafras oil, or safrole. You know what country produces the most safrole in the world? China. What a perfect coincidence. He Dongsheng would have slapped his thighs, but his hands were still tied up. Both Western and Chinese researchers have found that ingesting a small amount of MDMA is not harmful to human health, and they've not discovered any dangerous long-term side effects either. Since we could use it to make everyone in the country happy and thus improve our national stability, why shouldn't we do it? Didn't I say ours is a government that can accomplish big things? Once we said we'd do it, we did it. We built a well-managed high-spec factory in Hebei to turn out a product of scientifically guaranteed quality. Then we added MDMA to all our drinking water reservoirs and to cow's milk, soya milk, fizzy drinks, fruit juice, bottled water, beer and rice wine. Except for some very isolated areas, we covered over 99% of the urban population and over 70% of the rural population. Everyone drank such a small amount that it was totally undetectable in a standard urine test. People would never know they drank it, and it would only make them experience a mild euphoria. This was only a small supplementary program in support of our economic reform project. The real success of our action plan for achieving prosperity amid crisis was due to the correctness of our overall grand strategy. As the others listened to He Dongsheng, they broke out in a cold sweat. No wonder we've all been feeling a small high, exclaimed Old Chen in a burst of relieved enlightenment. Exactly, said Fang Chaodi. Over 99% of people in the cities are high all day, every day. How could you do this to the people without letting them know? Asked Little C a little disingenuously. Almost everything the Communist Party does, it does without informing the people, replied He Dongsheng. It's always been that way. Many other countries put chemicals in their drinking water. In Hong Kong, they put fluoride in the water to prevent tooth decay. It's all for the people's own good. Your policy, said Little C, is only designed to keep the people ignorant so they won't complain and just let you get away with everything. That was precisely our goal. Once you'd achieved your goal, asked Old Chen, why didn't you stop? With things going so well, why would we stop? What's wrong with having the whole population happy and maintaining a harmonious society? China today has the highest happiness index in the world. Religious believers are rapidly increasing, while domestic violence and the suicide rate for rural women are noticeably declining. What's wrong with all that? And besides, we really don't dare to stop now. If we do, the people might grow unhappy. Some foreigners who've lived in China for a long time begin to feel very strange when they go home. They don't feel as happy as they did in China, and they always want to come back. We have a great many international friends like them. When other foreigners criticize China, they stand up and defend us, telling their compatriots that if they went to live in China for a while, they'd see that the Chinese people are the happiest in the world. Not everyone has the same reaction, said Fang Chaodi. There are four of us here who have never been controlled by your drugged water. I'm telling you, said He Dongsheng, this is a good drug, but it's only a minor drug. There's no way it can control people. It just changes their feelings a bit. Whatever the people have to do, they can still do it. Our follow-up studies indicate that over 99% of people have the same positive reaction. But perhaps there is an extremely small number of people that, for one reason or another, don't have any reaction. It's good enough that the great majority feel happy, because any minority will have their emotions influenced by the majority. Of course,
There are some exceptions among the exceptions. I can see that you all belong to the extremely small minority made up of an extremely small number of people who remain unhappy. Just like me. I deliberately don't drink our Chinese water or other beverages just to experience what it feels like to see everybody else high when I'm sober. But today I fell off the wagon, as the Americans say. The effect is best the first time. Just look how much I talked after I drank a couple of glasses of your tap water. I've talked so much, including telling you all sorts of things I never should have. When did you start putting ecstasy in the water? The hitherto silent Zheng Du suddenly asked. Exactly what day was it?
Exact day is very clear, answered He Dongshen, beginning to cough. It was the last day of the 3-week crackdown. On that day, the waterworks of all first, second and third level cities and all provincial cities put it in the drinking water at the same time. That was because we were going to officially announce the start of China's Age of Ascendancy the next day, and we had to properly calibrate the people's emotions.
I'll kill you, you bastard! Shouted Zheng Du.
He sprang onto He Dongshen and pressed He's feeble body down into the chair with the full weight of his hulking frame.
I'll kill you, you bastard!
The others frantically tried to pull him off, but Zheng Du was too strong and they couldn't restrain him.
Zheng Du, let him go! Are you mad?
The three of them shouted. He Dongshen was making choking noises. His face had gone a deep red.
He hurt Mao Mao! He's the bastard who poisoned Mao Mao!
Shouted Zheng Du with his hands closing around He Dongsheng's throat. It looked like he was going to choke He Dongsheng to death right there in front of them. Suddenly, Miao Miao gave a big scream. Zheng Du loosened his grip on He Dongsheng and turned to look at her. Miao Miao was standing in the doorway with a plate of cookies in her hand. She was staring at Zheng Du. Zheng Du climbed off gingerly. He had almost murdered their hostage, and the other three were very shaken. He Dongsheng, rescued from the grip of death, still had not caught his breath and was struggling to speak.
He's the one who poisoned Miao Miao, repeated Zheng Du. Miao Miao started to act strange, like she was sick, the day the crackdown ended, and it was all because they put that shit in the water.
You're mad. You're all stark raving mad, you...
gasped He Dongsheng hoarsely. For a moment, he thought he'd just dare them to kill him and get it over with. But his logic took hold and he decided that daring these kidnappers to do such a thing might not be in his best interests. Old Chen was still the most cool-headed. He approached He Dongsheng with a glass of water, but He Dongsheng deliberately looked away. I'll untie you so you can drink some water, okay? Old Chen said gently. He Dongsheng was somewhat moved. Old Chen loosened the rope. What just happened was unplanned, he said. Whether you believe it or not, the roosters are just about to crow and then it'll be light. Your long, dark night is about over. Just be patient a little while longer, all right? Do you have any more questions to ask? Old Chen addressed the other three while he helped pour water into He Dongsheng's dry throat.
Yes, I almost forgot, said Fang Chaodi. That lost month, or strictly speaking, that lost 28 days. Professor He, the 1 week of anarchy and the 3-week crackdown that you just told us about, except for the three of us and you, everyone I've asked about it doesn't remember that time. Old Chen, you don't remember either, do you?
I really don't have any memory at all, answered Old Chen. He Dongsheng started to laugh, sort of gurgling from his throat. It was still hard for him to talk.
I'd like another glass of water, he said as he swallowed to clear his throat.
Professor He, pressed Fang Chaodi, can you explain it to us? That year when everyone was given a bird flu vaccination, it was really a drug created by the Office of Stability Maintenance to make us all forget, right?
No, it wasn't, corrected He Dongsheng. The bird flu vaccination was to prevent bird flu, and only 10 or 20 million people were actually vaccinated. Where would the Office of Stability Maintenance find such an amazing amnesiac drug? It would be wonderful if we did have one. Then our Communist Party could rewrite its history any way it wanted to.
Then what was the real reason why everyone forgot? Asked Fang Chaodi.
Was it the ecstasy in the water? Asked Little C.
How should I know? He Dongshan began to laugh again, a real, genuine, mirthful laugh. If you ask me for the real reason, I can only tell you that I haven't a clue. Don't think we can control everything. Many things happen that are beyond our expectations. We never dreamed that the month you're talking about would just disappear from people's memories. If you don't know, then who does? Asked Fang Xiaodi. Don't try to keep anything from us. I'm not trying to hide anything. Let me tell you everything I know. After the action plan for achieving prosperity amid crisis began to meet with some success, the first sentence in a People's Daily editorial was, "Since the global economy has entered a period of crisis, China's golden age of ascendancy has officially begun." It was only editorial rhetoric to put these two events together in the same sentence. After that, the sentence was picked up. It ricocheted across the media until everybody could recite it by heart. At that time, the Central Propaganda Bureau issued another report that mention of the intervening 28 days was dwindling even on the internet. We thought people couldn't stand to remember those hard times and everyone was too busy making and spending money. This was very good for the party. Anarchy and suppression are not exactly splendid states. They are bloody affairs, even sinful if you're a religious person. So the Propaganda Bureau took advantage of the situation and forbade all news media, including the internet, from discussing those 28 days. You know, China's internet control techniques are the best in the world, and of course, the traditional media wouldn't dare disobey our orders. Besides that, after China's prosperity and ascendancy began, everybody lost interest in the West. Now, the Chinese people prefer to watch our own colourful media, and only a tiny minority still watch non-Chinese media sources. In this way, those already rarely discussed 28 days completely disappeared from our public discourse. And then, something unimaginable happened that to this day I still cannot fathom. More and more people genuinely forgot those 28 days. And it was not just temporary memory loss, but they absolutely could not remember that time, just as though the whole country had unconsciously erased some painful childhood trauma. People in middle age and above had not really forgotten the earlier Cultural Revolution and 4th of June 1989. It was just that during those 2 years of China's ascendancy, everybody was living very well, and very few people had any interest in recalling the Cultural Revolution and June 1989. So those memories just naturally faded away. But people were really unable to remember those 28 days. Whether this was related to the water or not, I can't say for sure. The leaders living in Zhongnanhai have their own drinking water. We don't drink what the rest of the people drink, although there might have been a few of us without sufficient self-discipline who went around drinking ordinary water, I can't say for certain. What I can tell you is that most of the leaders in Zhongnanhai can definitely recall those 28 days, and they are all